On this episode of Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by pilot and airport management expert Michael Jones. He explains why most GA airports are poorly managed, what he learned by going back to college after age 60, and his favorite thing about the Cessna 210. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, everyone. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion from Sporties. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for show links and complete archives, and send us an email with your comments or guest ideas. You can find us at podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Jones, a U.S. Air Force veteran and a 4,000-hour commercial pilot, who, in addition to a 40-year career in business, served for 8 years on a General Aviation Airport Authority in North Carolina, most recently as chairman. In 2020, he went back to college, earning a PhD at the University of Florida while studying airport management. He summarized some of that research in a recent Airfax article, which we'll link to in the show notes and which we'll talk about here. Mike, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thank you very much. A real pleasure to be here.
I want to start with that article in Airfax, which was based on some of your research. You wrote, quote, "New research from the University of Florida has found that approximately 54% of the nearly 5,000 publicly owned airports in the United States are failing to perform as well as they should be doing, mostly due to simple mismanagement. This condition costs local airports an average of $20 million annually in lost economic impact, which extrapolates to about $35 billion annually on the national level." That's a big number for sure. And before we get into the details of that, let's start with the big picture. As we talk about GA airports, what should the role be of a GA airport? Why is it there? Lots of the public talk about airline airports that can picture O'Hare or JFK, but why does a GA airport exist?
That is the fundamental question that every airport should be asking themselves. Most of our citizens, our neighbors, know about airports only from flying commercial airlines. And if you don't have a commercial airline, then who needs that airport? Those of us who fly GA, of course, know and love these small airports. And the reason they exist, the reason they should exist, is going back thousands of years. And I'm going to twist your brain a little bit here, but the really great cities of the world are all ports. Venice was a great seaport. London was a seaport. New York City was a seaport. And on the great cities, ports are places where people and products intermingle and create new combinations. And in so doing, they create wealth and prosperity. Your little neighborhood GA airport is that exact same phenomenon on a much smaller scale. And so by having airports, we can create economic prosperity for flyers and non-flyers, for people who never even walk on that airport, but they benefit from the jobs it creates, the transportation it provides, the commerce that's incentivized by it. That's why we need our small airports. Now, question for you. How many airports are there in the United States?
Well, I've seen stats that there's somewhere north of 14,000 total landing facilities when you include private ones, and I think less than 1,000 of those are served by airlines. So the vast majority are these smaller community airports you're talking about.
Exactly right. According to the FAA, there are just over 20,000 landing facilities in the United States. There are more landing facilities in the United States than in the entire rest of the world combined. So we have a wonderful situation here that is, you know, rich with potential. And the study that I did with the University of Florida really shows it's not being used to its full potential.
And why is that? What's the story behind the poor performance? And how do you measure that even?
Well, the measuring part was tricky. The why is almost a mystery. I would venture to say that most airports are managed the way they are purely because of momentum. It is a function of governments to simply go by that what you did yesterday is what you do today, what you're going to do tomorrow. There's no profit and loss incentive. There's no going out of business for a government. And so they muddle along, sometimes for decades, kind of just underperforming because they don't really know any better and they don't understand the value that they're losing. So in my study, as you correctly summarized, the average GA airport produces only $20 million of economic impact to their community a year. But the ones that are operated in a successful manner, more active and engaged management, produce about $50 million a year. So if you took those thousands of mismanaged small GA airports, and there literally are thousands of them, and you upped their game, kicked it up a notch, as Emeril likes to say, you could boost probably something on the order of an additional $30 to $50 billion to the U.S. economy. And even in our economy, that's a big number.
Now, some people would say that an airport is not a business, and so you're measuring this performance incorrectly. What would you say to them?
I would say they're precisely right and exactly wrong, all right? Airports, managing an airport for sheer profit is probably not a good metric. It's a useful metric. But most county governments and city governments, which own most of our GA airports, actually don't even have software that allows them to compute profit and loss. All right. They use it a totally different kind of accounting than you and I are used to as business people, you know, where there's an income statement, you got revenue, you got expenses, and there's the little profit at the bottom. They do a thing called fund accounting, which doesn't track margins, doesn't track cost of goods sold. You're really trying to hammer a square peg into a round hole. And so they can't measure financial performance. A better metric, and one that's available in almost every state in the country, is total economic impact. And these are computed usually by independent agencies. In my case, the Department of Aviation here in North Carolina, and Department of Aviation in Florida, and so on. And what they do is they do a study using what are called input-output models and measure the total economic impact that that airport produces. And this is done all the time, by the way. This is done for highways. Or you'll hear, oh, we need to put a new football stadium in our city, and it's going to cost $500 million, but it's going to produce $1 billion of economic impact. Hospitals do it, seaports, railroads. It's quite a well-known and fairly robust and reliable metric. So to have an independent umpire measuring the performance of your airport and comparing it to the other airports becomes a real handy tool and doesn't rely on the funky accounting used by municipal accounting systems.
There's a massive hangar shortage at many GA airports right now. Do you think this is related to poor management or is something else going on there?
It is absolutely a symptom of the exact behavior I'm describing. Somebody in City Hall sits there and says, wow, new hangar, $4 million. I could build half of a new elementary school for $4 million. I could pave roads for $4 million, new sewer system. How many people will use those new roads, schools, and so, ooh, boy, that's a big number. How many people will use the airport? Oh, there's only 100 airplanes. Guess what? The airport loses. And they lose again and again and again because the city manager and county commissioners aren't looking at the real big picture, which is the total economic impact. Here's an interesting piece of trivia for you, John. In most communities, the airport is the only business operated by the community that's supposed to make a profit. Everything else is overhead. You know, roads and sewers and schools, they don't have any revenue. Only the airport is expected to stand on its own two feet.
Well, this gets to a key point in your Airfax article. You talk about the structure for managing an airport and a single function organization chart and other options. So walk us through that in terms of how an airport is structured in terms of management and what the incentives are.
That is exactly the heart of what I studied. And the analogy that I like to make is a Swiss Army knife. If you have a Swiss Army knife, you can sharpen a pencil, you can turn screws, you can punch holes in a leather belt, does all sorts of things. It doesn't do any one of those tasks particularly well. There are better tools for each of those, but if you want to do a lot of little things and put it in your pocket, it's a very convenient. So a Swiss Army knife is a multi-function tool. And a better way to punch a hole in a piece of leather is to get a tool designed for exactly that task. Now let's go back over to the city government. The city government says, we've got this airport here. Where do we put it? Well, they mow a lot of grass, so let's put it in the parks department. Oh, no, not the parks department. Let's put it in the highway department because it's got a long piece of concrete that looks like a highway, and maybe we'll run a snowplow up and down it every now and then. Okay, it's in the highway department. Well, what does the highway department do with this? Do they know how to get federal grants? Do they know about NPIS designation? Do they know about Part 139 rules? Do they know what a ROFA and a ROSA are in terms of airport design? No, they don't. And they don't have time to learn because they're busy off, you know, patching potholes and doing the things that highway departments do. So as a result of that, of being lumped into a highway department, paving roads, sewers, and all that, the airport tends to wither. It doesn't get the attention. It doesn't have the expertise it needs to grow and prosper. Now, turn it around and look at what, in my study, was termed an airport authority, but it could be an airport board, airport commission, sometimes even a port authority. That becomes an organization tasked with only doing one thing: run the airport successfully, make it grow and prosper. Hopefully, they're even using the economic measures I described of total economic impact. We're going to run this airport to maximize the economic impact for all of our community. All of a sudden now, well, we could use a new hangar. We got a waiting list of 100 people. Let's build 20 hangars and see what we can do. Hey, there's a business that wants to come here and build parachutes or assemble airplanes made in the Czech Republic or do, you know, avionics repair. And they're going to have 10 employees and those employees will pay taxes. And that would be a good thing too. So a designated airport authority, relatively autonomous and independent from the county government or city government, will outperform the multifunction, the Swiss Army knife model, every time. In fact, just looking at the raw data, they outperform by 20 times. It's not a little bit. It's not even close. They do 20 times better than when it's lumped into the Parks Department.
I think what's interesting about your approach here is it's not just academic. Yes, you went and studied this and got a PhD, but you're also a longtime pilot and you spent many years on your local airport board. So from that perspective, operating the airport or being involved in that, what's a key piece you learned that maybe you didn't know when you first started that process? What a typical GA pilot, what do we not understand about our local airport?
Let me tell you that I have a... That is a profound question. And I will tell you this. Managing an airport and running it properly is way, way harder than I ever thought it was. There are so many fingers in the pie: FAA rules, state rules, engineering rules, the fire marshal, for heaven's sake. All of those people jump in the pie and everybody's tugging you in different directions. And it gets even worse if you have airline service at your airport. So it takes real training, understanding the technologies, understanding how to test asphalt. You know, asphalt has a finite life. Then after 20 or 25 years, you got to pull it up and replace it unless you've done things to sustain it. All of these were new to me when I got on the airport authority. And it took years to really get my arms around the grant process. How do you write a good grant that will work? How to go to your state legislature and politic for your airport? That's a whole new world that we only started in the last year or 18 months. How do you reach out to the business community? We actually built a business advisory board who came to the airport and looked around and said, hey, did you ever think of doing that? Or if we painted it purple, would we put more people in our hotels? Don't know. Good question. Let's think about it. So the complexity, do you remember Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense years ago, right before the Gulf War. And he gave a great speech. Somebody asked him what keeps him up at night as they're getting ready to do that battle. And he said, well, you know, there are things we know about our enemy and our capabilities, and there are things we know we don't know. We know there's gaps in our intelligence. We know there are gaps in our understanding of their weapons. Then he said, but the thing that keeps me up at night are the things that I don't know that I don't know. Big, huge holes in my understanding that could turn out and you know, punch me in the nose. And that's what it is when you have the highway department trying to run an airport. They're lovely people. They're doing the best they can. They're not malicious. They just don't know what they don't know. So that, I think, comes down to the core of the situation. Can I give you an example, a very specific example? I was looking through my research, and I thought about Venice, Florida. Nice little GA airport down on the Gulf Coast. It's got a population in its area of 224,000 people, and 87,000 of those people are employed, which is a pretty good number. And one of the statistics that I developed for my study was economic intensity, which is how much money is being raised or generated in that community. And it's $78 million per square mile. That is a very strong number, all right? A lot of communities, like farming communities, it's $10 million a square mile. So Venice is doing really well, all right? Its actual economic impact is $53 million. It's run by the county, and my model says it should be producing $112 million. Do you know on their website, I actually went and looked just before we came on the air, their website has more about their pickleball courts than it has about their airport.
I'm not surprised.
I rest my
that.
Case. I mean, it's just, where are the votes? Where are the people? That's where the governments go. So you got to run it like a business. You got to get the politicians out. Am I raving too much? Am I sounding like a crazed lunatic here? I apologize.
No, I love the passion. This is an important and overlooked subject. I guess my question to follow all that would be, if I'm a local pilot and I care about my airport and I think it could be run better, what's a constructive way for me to get involved? What should I do?
Well, one thing that I would recommend highly is, let me send you my PowerPoint on the dissertation, because it has great slides that will educate you and your fellow pilots and hopefully the local government about getting rid of the Swiss Army knife model and going to the single function model. And then I think you really have to engage with your local government. And you say, guys, this airport isn't working, and it hasn't worked for years, and we don't have enough hangars, and there are weeds growing in the taxiways. And that's a failure. And do you, as the city manager, as the county executive, do you want to be involved with a failure? Or would you like to be the hero who made it right, who fixed it, and turned this around? And I think if you approach it from that way, not pointing fingers and saying you're bad, you're a bad manager, but simply saying, hey, we've learned now that there's another way to do it. We've measured, we have quantitative statistical proof it will do better, and now we'd like to give that a try. Now, that will be a leap of faith for your county officials and elected officials. Boy, do I take a risk? Do I trust these people on the airport authority? What if they don't do a good job? Well, hang on, because you're not doing a good job now. The downside risk is actually pretty limited. The upside is enormous. In the case of Venice, $50, $60 million. So I think that's where it starts, by engaging with your local officials and suggesting there's room for improvement.
Yeah, identifying the problem may be the key first step there. It's just not bumping along like you have for the last 20 years, as you suggested.
Exactly right. Now, that brings up another issue, though, and this is a serious one, which is, who do we put on this new airport authority? And you can get bad airport authorities. In fact, in my study, I was getting strange errors in my statistics. And when I dove into it, I found that about 20% of the airport authorities were not what I term active and engaged airport authorities. So I'm going through this and I'm thinking, if I've got two, the FAA data says there are two airport authorities here, but one's doing great, one's doing poorly. How can I, using publicly available data, determine or measure or quantify that gap? And you know what I did? I found out I could do it from the airport's website. And I found that there were 10 or 12 very specific things that a good airport does. And it, for example, it publishes its rules and standards on the website. It publishes minutes of the meetings on the website. It publishes the names and phone numbers of the people who are managing the airport and who's on the airport authority. So they're not just hiding behind a silicon wall, but you can actually call them on their cell phone and say, hey, this is screwed up. And if they do those, so out of my 235 airports that were in my study, one airport got all 12 points. The average was 3.1 out of 12. And 84 airports got zero.
Wow.
So that became a very interesting measure of the airport's authority's engagement. Who would be on an airport authority? That becomes the question everyone else asks. Maybe we should have elected officials be on the airport authority so they'll represent the different towns in the county, let's say. Terrible idea. Don't do it. All you've just done is recreate the problem in a different shape. Get the politicians out. There's only one political official who should be on an airport authority, and that is the guy who's in charge of economic development in your community. He's interested in growing businesses. You're interested in growing businesses. You can work together. After that, you need people who are experts in marketing and business, you know, making those tough hire and fire decisions. You need people who are expert in finance. You need people who are expert in engineering, like civil engineering or some form like that. Yeah, it's too much to say, oh, I'd like to get an engineer who worked for the FAA. They're relatively rare. But there are civil engineers who like to fly and are involved with the... Here's another piece of trivia for you. Less than half the people on an airport authority should be pilots.
Interesting.
Less than half. You get too many pilots on there, it becomes a club to protect their hangar rates, and they end up making bad decisions.
Fascinating insight, Michael. This is fantastic. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with some more questions.
You passed your private pilot check ride, and you might even have an instrument rating. Now what? Do you feel confident enough to use your pilot certificate in the real world? Sporties is proud to partner with Pilot Workshops to offer a selection of video courses and manuals that will improve your flying skills and build your confidence so you can get out and fly. Produced by Pilot Workshops' team of expert flight instructors and delivered in Sporties' easy-to-use pilot training app, these learning tools are packed with practical tips that go far beyond the textbook. Topics include airplane engines, IFR procedures, emergency strategies, communications, and more. Visit sporties.com/pilotworkshops to learn more. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Mike Jones, who went back to college in 2020, later in life. Now, Mike, you said that in many cases you were learning from professors who were younger than you, which is sort of like many pilots who learn from a flight instructor who may be younger than they are. So do you have any tips or lessons learned from that experience you could share?
It was a remarkable experience, I got to tell you. I went to the Warrington School of Business, which is at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. And showing up with gray hair surprised everybody, I got to tell you. I was the oldest student by a long shot. And as you just correctly noted, I was older than all of the professors in the class. But I will tell you, they treated me with great respect. They were very thoughtful when I offered my comments. And it was fun because, for example, we're doing statistical programs, advanced statistical techniques. Well, I learned those techniques when I got my MBA at Columbia University 50 years ago. Using computer punch cards. Have you ever even seen a computer punch card?
I have.
You know, and I was telling the students and the professors about this, and they were like, you did this with punch cards? Like, wow. So it was a great experience. I'm so glad I did it. But I will tell you, I am so glad it's done. We ended up going down to Gainesville every 6 weeks. So I flew down in my Cessna, which was wonderful and convenient. Other people had to drive for hours and hours. And they would beat our brains out for 3 or 4 days every 6 weeks. And then I know your viewers won't be able to see this, but I can show it to you. See this book?
Wow.
This is the reading for one class for 1 6-week period. And they just never stopped. And I read every word, and I'm very proud of my accomplishments. In fact, just speaking to the dissertation and the research, I'm proud to say that they are using my dissertation as a template for the incoming students and saying, this is what you're supposed to do. This guy did it right. So I'm rather proud of that accomplishment.
Understandably so. That's great. Now, you mentioned the Cessna. I've got to ask about that because it's a Cessna 210, I believe. You've flown one for many, many years. It's one of my all-time favorite airplanes. I've got a few hundred hours in one, an N model that I love flying around. What is your favorite thing about that airplane?
It's versatility, without a doubt. It is simply the most versatile machine you can possibly imagine. It is also money-sucking hole in the sky, I will tell you. Do not get a 210 if you're trying to pinch pennies. That would be a bad idea. But it stalls at 49 knots. I had wingtip vortices put on, and I can stall that at 49 knots, and I've had it up to 258 knots going over the ground on one famous flight from Omaha to Boston. I was going so fast landing in Boston, I started my approach over Buffalo. And I was able to do that because I was up in the flight levels, turbocharged, sucking on oxygen, but it was just an amazing, exhilarating experience.
Yeah, it's the original SUV.
Is there any other airplane that has a useful load of 1,600 pounds? I have 120 gallons of fuel. I can fly. The plane can fly for 7 hours. I cannot. I mean, and it carries six people. So when I go to Oshkosh, my buddy Alex and I, we take all the seats out, load it up with camping gear. I take a generator to Oshkosh. I mean, just all the stuff you can imagine. And I'm still hundreds of pounds under the max gross weight. It's just a remarkable baby.
Yeah, I remember the one I flew. I want to say the full fuel payload was like 1,200 pounds. I mean, it's the original aerial SUV. If it fits, it ships in that airplane, which is really rare these days. Now, you mentioned turbo, and you told me that you had that 210 at 27,000 feet once, which is extremely, it's high for a lot of turboprops. That's very high for a piston. So what was the feeling like in a Cessna 210 at flight level 270?
Do you know what? It's just like flying it at 200 feet. The airspeed, I was surprised. Of course, airspeed is calculated from the ram air coming into the pitot tube, right? Well, there's not much air coming in. So the airspeed trickles down. I'm normally flying at 145 indicated, which is about 165 true. And then the airspeed was down to 100. But she was stable. She was comfortable. The heater kept us warm. And that was one particular flight over the Rockies from Grand Rapids to the Midwest. And we just had to get over some storms. Another time I did it, I was up at 27,000 feet. I literally went over a thunderstorm.
Wow.
Over near Atlanta, Georgia. You know what's else interesting about an airplane with that cape? It takes a long time to come down. It takes 40 minutes. At 500 feet a minute, it takes 40 minutes to get back down to near the pattern altitude. It's you really have to do planning long, long in advance.
Now, do you think the turbocharged engine has a bad reputation? You fly turbo, obviously. There's turbo and non-turbo 210s, turbo and non-turbo Cirrus SR22s. You go down the list. So historically, turbos had a bad reputation. Oh, they're great for getting up high and going fast, but they're a maintenance nightmare. Do you think that's an old wives' tale, or is there some validity to that?
Well, I can tell you this. I think my particular airplane has outperformed all of my expectations. I have 1,800 hours on a Continental 520, and I have just placed the order to buy a new one. But, I mean, 1,800 hours, you're, you know, going 165 knots for hour after hour, it's just a remarkable machine. I think the turbo is a very accommodating feature. Now, I will tell you this, I still run Rich of Peak. I know I'm old-fashioned, that's what the gray hair does, but I think that's one of the reasons I've gone 1,800 hours and replaced one cylinder. And that was after about 200 hours. So I think that was infant mortality. That engine has been rock solid.
Fascinating stat there. I agree with you on Richard Peak. Some airplanes love Richard Peak. Some love Lena Peak. It's not one size fits all for sure.
Well, my friend Paul New, who runs Tennessee Aircraft Services, I'm sure you've spoken to Paul. He is an avid proponent of Lean of Peak. And I kind of think, like, why do I want to go slower? You know, it's just the whole point of an airplane is to go where you want to go fast.
All right, Michael, we always end this show with our rapid fire ready to copy segment. So here I'll throw out some questions on a variety of topics, try to keep you on your toes. And you fire back with your quick answer. Are you ready to copy?
I'm ready.
What's an example of a simple management mistake that most airports make? Something that doesn't require big political influence. Just stop doing this now.
Privatizing the FBO. It's so easy for airports to say, hey, we don't want to hire all these people. We don't want to have to worry about payroll and stuff. Let's just rent it out to somebody. 90% of the time, and I have the actual statistics, they underperform. It's a terrible mistake. Keep the FBO, keep the fuel sales, keep the money to run the airport.
How about a private airport entirely? Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
There are very few private airports that make a significant economic contribution to their community. They're understaffed, under-resourced, and run in an amateur manner. No matter how enthusiastic the owners might be, they just don't have the firepower to deliver the big benefits. Now, there's a private airport right near me, Carthage, North Carolina, with the Pick and Pig restaurant. And on a sunny Saturday afternoon, they'll have 40 airplanes on the ramp. But that doesn't compare with Venice, with Vero Beach, with even here at Pinehurst, where we outperform that airport every day of the week.
That is a great restaurant if you're down in that area.
Oh, have you been there?
I have. I've got a question for you about barbecue coming up, maybe. So stay tuned. Let's talk about Young Eagles first, though. I see you've flown over 800 Young Eagles, which congratulations. That is a fantastic number. What's a tip you can share for a new Young Eagles pilot? Maybe I'm going out for my first flight with kids. What's something you've learned over the years that I can do to make it a smooth flight?
Listen to the kids who stop talking, okay? When they're going up and the first time they turn the plane and you're having fun and everybody's screaming and they're like, look at this, I can see swimming. I can see McDonald's from here. And then all of a sudden, one of the kids stops talking. He is just about to throw up. Get on the ground, quick.
That's a fantastic tip. I agree with that 100%. I've seen that. Silence is bad news in the cockpit like that.
You know, the only person who's ever gotten sick in my airplane was a parent. The kids did great.
Let's go back to 210s. A niche question, but one that I have feelings on. Should 210s have gear doors or not? The original ones had complicated folding gear doors. The later ones were taken off either by mod or from the factory. So what's the right way, gear doors or no?
Gear doors, no. All right. And the reason for that happens to be very specific to the 210, and that is the wheel wells for the gear are not in the airflow. They are way tucked out of the way. Any drag that could be created by that awkward shape is minimized by the fact the wind doesn't hit it. And so no gear doors, simplify your life. In my time in the airplane, I've had two gear warning landings. I declared an emergency both times. Both times it was a false alarm, but no gear doors.
You were in air traffic control in the Air Force, as I understand it. So did that experience influence you at all? Do you think about decision-making or weather or air traffic control differently with that background?
Absolutely. But let me first compliment you on your research. You've done a good job on it. That was 50 years ago, John. But yes, I got into aviation because of my experience as an air traffic controller, ended up in Vietnam. I was there right at the end of the war when Saigon was falling, and I was actually the guy who issued the recall command when the generals finally decided it was all over. So I recalled all the airplanes on our radar that we were talking to. And that makes you a tremendous evaluator of your options. You like a pilot, an air traffic controller has to have a plan A, a plan B, and a C and a D behind that. Because just when things go bad, they can even go worser. So always, and this might be a good life lesson, always have a plan B and a plan C.
Yeah, I think that's a habit of pilots. I know this. They have a plan B when they go to the bathroom. Let's talk about North Carolina. You mentioned you live in Pinehurst, a place famous for golf, a beautiful place. What is your favorite golf course in the Carolinas? Is it Pinehurst or is there some hidden gem somewhere else?
I would vote for the airport. Listen to me. I would vote for the golf course that I happen to live on. And it took me 16 years to find a house on this golf course, but it's called Mid Pines. It's 120 some odd years old. It was designed by Donald Ross. And what's interesting about Mid Pines is it's owned by two companies. And they fought for years. And so they have never done all of the modernizing that is so often done to other golf courses. And And what that means is you're playing the course very much as Donald Ross did it. And they host the Hickory National Tournament here. And so we'll go out in our ties, we wear jackets, we wear plus fours, and we play golf with wooden golf clubs that are 100 years old. And it is a step back in time. It's a magical, magical weekend.
That sounds great. I had not heard of that, but that sounds like a wonderful idea. All right, another North Carolina question. You mentioned barbecue. I went to college down in North Carolina and fell in love with the state's distinctive style of barbecue, more vinegar, less sugar. Where would you rank it? Are you a North Carolina barbecue purist, or is Kansas City or Memphis? Who's got the best?
Oh, that's an interesting question. And I got to tell you, I have never accustomed myself to the vinegar barbecue. And that's what you get when you go to the Carthage Airport to the Pick and Pig restaurant. And some people love it. I'm more of a tomato guy. I'm more of a St. Louis style guy. That's where my heart is. But hey, they're all good. You know, the worst barbecue I ever had was still pretty good.
I agree with you enthusiastically. No gear doors on the 210. We'll have to agree to disagree on barbecue. That's okay.
Oh, no.
All right, Mike, our last question is always the same on pilot's discretion. You have one final flight, and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
One final flight. I'm going to go to Alaska. You know, In fact, my buddy Alex and I have been talking about that. I would love to go fly in Alaska. There are great people up there, great scenery, and it's a real challenge in terms of weather and capabilities. I'm going to do that. You know, I'm getting too old. I got to go do these fun things. So I'm going to go to Alaska. Thank you for putting that thought in my head.
Mike, thanks for your passion and your energy, and thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure, John. And may I just offer my email address to your listeners? We've gotten so many. By the way, another thing, John, tell your advertisers. I got a million emails from Airfax. You guys have real marketing clout. You reach people. But I'd like to offer my email to your listeners and say, if you have a bad airport, if you're having questions about it, they can reach out to me at pilotmike2012@gmail.com. And I will answer every request.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Mike. Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.